Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
I think it's safe to say that you can't truly understand alcoholism unless you've been an alcoholic or lived with one. Medically, it's considered a disease, but alcoholism goes much further and deeper than that. The mental, physical, personal aspects of life are severely affected, turned upside down. My next guest will give us an insight into what it's like to live with an alcoholic and then become one. Also mixed in with this absorbing story is a surprise that dawned much later in my next guest's life, that his father wasn't the stockbroker he'd claimed. He was a spy working in America's Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. Ian Morgan Cron has written about a rich array of powerful experiences in his book called Jesus, My Father, the CIA, and Me. It's a moving, heartfelt, very real story. Ian, welcome to Open House.
Well, thank you. It's a joy to be with you.
I've really been looking forward to speaking with you for a very long time, since I saw this title, in fact. Ian, can I go back at the start of the journey? You describe your childhood as a J shape with high years and really low years. When did you realize your life was quite different, not quite the same as other children?
It was probably pretty early. We had so many features of our lives that were not as rooted or as anchored as other kids. We moved around a great bit, and there were so many contradictions to our lives. You know, we were at one point very wealthy, and then we were very, I wouldn't say, my mother would say, we weren't impoverished, we were broke. She used to say, there's a big difference between poor and broke.
Yes.
Broke is temporary, and poor is permanent. And yet, at the same time, we had a British nanny living in our home. So there were all these kind of crazy, contradictory things about our lives. And of course, my father's alcoholism. You didn't have to be very old as a child to figure out that there was something very, very wrong.
What was it about your family's life? Was it just your father's alcoholism that made it so erratic?
When you have an addict in the house, they aren't the only ones who become a little kooky. You know, you have to, everyone else in the family has to bend their behaviors and their way of life to accommodate the craziness of a parent that's an addict. You know, everyone eventually becomes part of a very sick system, contributing actually in many ways to its continuance.
So what words would you use to describe what it was like growing up as a child with that dawning realization of his great difficulties?
It was fearful, it was lonely, and it was sad. Those are the three words that I would pick if I, you know, had to characterize my childhood. Is that to say that there weren't times of, you know, joy and fun and riding bikes and all that stuff? Of course. But always looming in the life of a child living in an alcoholic home, always looming on the horizon is this uncertainty of, you know, what will greet me when I come home. It is so unpredictable.
Fear played a large part in your young life, fear of your father?
Yes, because he was very unpredictable, right? I mean, he could be charming, he could be rageful, he could be terribly funny at times. You were just uncertain as to which father you were coming home to. Mm. When you're a little kid, by the way, you also assume that all of this is probably your fault. That if you were a better child, a better son, a better student, a better athlete, a better musician, whatever it was, that your parent, your father, you know, would love you more, wouldn't need to drink, and everything would be better. And of course, it takes a long time to realize, of course, that that's not the case.
My heart's wrenched for that kind of experience. You had a nanny as a child as well. Did she help stabilize your life somewhat?
Oh, she was the anchor for our home in many, many ways. She was the most predictable, steady, gentle, warming presence in our home. And often our greatest and most fearless defender with my father. I came very close to dedicating the book to her because she was so instrumental in showing me a little bit of grace and hopefulness about life.
What about your mother, Ian?
You know, my mom, who is wonderful and who I did dedicate the book to because she's a remarkable human being and someone for whom I have just tremendous affection. My mother was out there trying to figure out how to keep us afloat at different times. Her priorities were very pragmatic, you know, food on the table, get the kids to school, teeth brushed, you know, that sort of thing. Keep the wheels on as best she could. She occupied a different space, right, in my life, which was, what was that movie, you know, about Molly Brown, you know, the Titanic, the woman who single-handedly rescued everybody in the rescue boat. I mean, yes. That's kind of who my mother is.
You came to love music, and listening to the music on the radio ended up being an important part of your childhood.
Yeah, I mean, I love music still. I live in Nashville. You're talking to me right now. I'm in Nashville. My life is filled with musicians. Yeah, I mean, music for me was a refuge, and it was also a place where I could give voice to things I felt that I could not give voice to anywhere else. That, you know, oftentimes melody and lyric serve a purpose of applying language to feelings that can't be expressed any other way.
Yes.
Right? And so it was one of the many life rings that were tossed to me, for which I'm grateful.
Yes. You say the big change in your life was a day in year 7 when your school was snowed in. You went to a friend's house and started to drink. Tell us how things changed, how everything changed from then.
You know, the book is, I suppose in some ways it's very Irish, isn't it? You know, it's got that rather tragic side to it that meets comedy constantly. You know, where you see the absurdity when it meets tragedy. And that story is one of those in the book that is both funny and tragic at the same time, right?
Yes.
A couple of kids, seventh graders, 5 of us or so, were off of school for the day because of snow. We end up at a friend's house, and we get into the liquor cabinet because parents are at work. And what was for everybody else a one-time experience of drinking without any effect, for the most part, on their futures, for me, became the beginning of a long journey into becoming an alcoholic myself, which, as you know, statistically speaking, is very common.
Yes.
For children of alcoholics.
Did you ever reflect on the sense of circular futility, I'd call it, of a generation kind of replicating itself in alcoholism?
Alcoholism is very sneaky. You know, it comes up on you very, very slowly. You know, it's like a tide. You're in over your head before you know it, and you see or sense things along the way that something's not quite right, or you just don't believe it, you dismiss it, and the next thing you know, it's something you can't dismiss anymore.
Yes.
Did I reflect on it? No, not particularly at the time. Later, a great deal, and I'm very grateful that I'm one of the lucky few that has a chance to not make that particular egregious, terrible mistake that my father did with his own children with my own.
It's a real break from the past. Were you trying to get his attention by this stage of your life?
I didn't succeed during my life at capturing his attention because the only thing that he was able to remain focused on was himself and his addiction, really. Those are the two things that mattered to him the most. And now, as an older man, years past that, I think we all carry within us the gene to please the father, whether they're alive or not. That's the nature of being human. But I'm not as unconscious of that as I was, and I feel like this book was a great opportunity to release the need to win the approval of somebody who's not even alive anymore.
Yes, indeed it is too. On Open House, we're speaking with Ian Morgan Cron, the author of Jesus, My Father, the CIA, and Me. It's a wonderful title, Ian. Can you take us the story of how you first found out that your father worked as a spy in the CIA?
Well, it's interesting. I'm always sort of having to qualify so much when I answer this question, because I actually don't know entirely what my father did. And I also think that it was not just with the Central Intelligence Agency, it was also with other intelligence services as well. My father was always a mystery to us. He didn't have very many friends, and it wasn't because he wasn't charming or sociable. He was very charming and sociable. His jobs were always changing. We didn't know who he worked with. I guess for a period of it, we would just sort of said, well, he's got a drinking problem, and that's why all this happens. And then as time went on, we realized it was more complicated than that. And he was being considered for a position in the intelligence services overseas. So what we suspected by that point was confirmed, that he had, throughout the course of our lives, and before that, certainly in the 50s, been involved in the intelligence services at their earliest age. You know, this was post-World War II, so yes, the Central Intelligence Agency would have been just a few years old. That's when we knew for sure, because they had to speak to all of us in the house about how we felt about it. They wanted to know who we were. That was an interesting discovery.
Yes. And you find a Polaroid photo of him with President Ford.
Ford is way on. Well, he's not way up. He's in the distance. They're up on a putting green in Vail. My father's in the foreground. And so that would have been around the same time that this conversation took place about the possible position in the intelligence services overseas. So my hunch is he was there meeting the president, part of a vetting process, I would assume.
And he maintained that he was a stockbroker.
Well, he was many things. His first involvement, he was in the motion picture business and television business throughout the 50s, early 60s in England. And I know that's when he was working deeply with the intelligence services. You know, he worked in the oil industry, worked as a stockbroker. You have to remember that people who we might call spies, right, are people embedded inside of corporations.
Yes.
They're not working in embassies. They're not working for the military, per se. Those are obvious people. It's people who are trained and then working inside of American corporations overseas who are there for the long haul and who have a business card. They may have some, you know, relationship to what the company's doing, but the real company they're working for, at least in parallel, is with the intelligence services. And they're also the ones who are most at risk, because the government will not come to their defense if they're caught.
No.
The government will disavow them.
So in the meantime, you are studying hard, you're partying hard, you have mm-hmm. several near-death experiences. Tell me about your friend Tyler and the part that Tyler played in your life.
There were lots of us who partied that hard. For me, the partying just didn't end as soon as it did for everybody else. Yeah. And we always seem to find the ones that are just like us, right? Tyler was just a remarkable guy that, again, another life ring that got thrown to me. He and I were great friends. We partied a great deal together. He became a Christian when we were in high school together and introduced me to that world of faith, at a time when I really desperately needed it. In many ways, that was the beginning of a journey home into being well.
He was the one who confronted you about your drinking.
He was. He wasn't the last, but he was a memorable first.
Yes.
For sure. There were only maybe four moments in the book where I found myself, as I was writing, becoming really emotional. And that moment with Tyler was one of them.
Why so emotional about that moment? Can you take us to that moment?
We were teenage boys. We were 16 years old, and he had the courage to say, look, you are becoming like your father, and when you drink too much, you act like him, you look like him, you talk like him, you're as condescending as he is. And he said, you're just too good a person to become what your father is. And Tyler knew what my father was like. He was one of the very few people I'd allow in my home. It just, you know, hit me like a ton of bricks, and I did the unthinkable, which is to cry in front of a friend, another guy friend at that age. And he so kindly just took me to himself, hugged me while I cried. That's just just remembering that moment, seeing it in my mind, was just very touching for me. It took a great deal of courage on his part.
Yes. You finally end up in a church, and forgiveness becomes a very big issue for you.
I think the ability to forgive someone who's deeply wounded you is a gift that's given to you. And you receive it because you're just open to the possibility that it can happen. But at that particular church service, I was angry at God, and I found myself at this church and really cynical and angry. And then it was during the Eucharistic celebration that I had this moment of clarity, and I could hear God, or I guess I heard in my own mind, some voice asking my forgiveness. And it was years later in seminary, in years of puzzling about it, that a woman, an African-American woman at a barbecue, assured me that it certainly was possible that Jesus, if he was willing to die on a cross to tell us how much he loved us, might be willing to say he was sorry to a 17-year-old or 16-year-old kid if he thought it could heal his heart. And now, interestingly, I've taken a little bit of flack for that, because people who are tend to be more concrete and want to talk about theology take objection, and I have to remind them, it's a memoir. You know, it's a story about a human life. Human lives do not necessarily follow the correct dictums or dogmas that we carry in theology.
You are, as you put it, still living a double life through college with alcohol and faith. Uh-huh. How did that juggle resolve itself then? What was the turning point for your alcoholism?
Well, you know, just to that point, though, you know, I think we're all living parallel lives of some kind.
Yes.
If you're on a faith journey, just living in a broken world, we're all very, very complicated. We're all addicts, by the way. It's all of us have addictions, everybody. We have public personas, and we have things that are hidden that we don't want others to see, that, like drinking, for example, or drugs, or whatever it might be. For me personally, the juggling became increasingly difficult. There was so much internal turmoil all the time. It's like what Paul says, you know, I end up doing the things I don't want to do, the things I don't want to do, I end up doing. Yes. There does come a point at which the pleasure of the addiction becomes less than the suffering caused by the addiction. You have to make a decision. You know, am I going to continue in this or am I not?
How hard was that decision?
So the decision to stop drinking wasn't that difficult, really. It was the year that my father died. Another member of my family went into recovery the same year. There were so many indications that I needed to arrest this problem in my life before it swallowed me wholesale. It was just really clear. And by grace, you know, again, another life ring gets thrown out, right? Hmm. People came around me who were able to lead me to places where I could get some help to do that. And then it really hasn't been that difficult. Today in Australia, it is my 25th anniversary of sobriety.
What a great day.
So you've got me on a good day.
I'm sure there have been many good days over the last 25 years. Are there words that you can use to describe the difference in this life over those 25 years to that that you had before?
Holy smokes. Well, there's just been so much redemption but also struggle, but no more than I think most have, to try and live into your own beauty. You know, the church often makes too much of people being broken. You know, that word gets thrown around a lot. And, you know, sin gets thrown around a lot. These are realities. I'm not discounting that. But one of the things that doesn't get mentioned enough is that we're beautiful. And that, in many ways, being beautiful is a terrible responsibility, and it is a terrible burden to carry, because we have to own that and live it and steward it and protect it. I guess over the years, I've dedicated a lot of energy to discovering that I'm a person that God made in his image, therefore I'm beautiful. And what does it mean to protect, love, and steward that, and actually cultivate the further growth of that beauty in my life?
And whether it's in Christian community or in the power of God, you're not alone in this.
Oh, no, no. In fact, the worst thing that can happen to any of us is that kind of isolation. We're just not meant to do life alone. Introvert, extrovert, doesn't matter. We're meant to be companioned in this life spiritually. For me, I can't do without a community around me that can mirror back the fact that I am, in fact, beautiful, that I can mirror back to them, you know, I can message back to them that they're beautiful, and that we have to be people who are continuing to evoke and use our God-given gifts to communicate that message to the rest of the world and try and participate in redeeming and reclaiming it for God's kingdom.
Well, you've done it across Australia tonight and beyond, because we have many listeners to Open House around the world. Ian, thank you so much indeed for your time, for your story. It's been a rich journey talking with you. Thank you so much.
Well, been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.